Kia ora, and thanks for joining me for another podcast in the wonderful series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, a series where I have the great privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood, I'm from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of the different ways you can listen. But now it's time for this interview with Rod Oram, a well-known business and climate commentator who likely needs little introduction. He's talking with me on the theme of making our urban or regional economy less vulnerable to climate. So here's the conversation between Rod Oram and me, which I do hope you enjoy as much as I did. Well, today it's my great pleasure to introduce Rod Oram to listeners. Rod probably takes little introduction to many people, but I just want to recap and say that he's a very well-known business commentator and very well-known also for integrating his business perspectives with climate change considerations. Rod received high acclaim for his series a couple of years ago on Fonterra, and then he also took considerable effort to get over to COP26 last year. I happen to know I was in discussions with Rod at the time, and he was passionate about being a New Zealand journalist over there. Rod, it's a really great pleasure to welcome you to Climate Matters and to our discussion of climate and local government. So thank you for being available to us.
Oh, well, thank you, Lindsay. It's a great pleasure to be having another conversation with you. And this is a terrific series you've lined up, culminating in talking to all the mayoral candidates. And I think that that's a wonderful, very good local participatory journalism and democracy in the making here.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rod. I hope I do get to talk to them all because, of course, it's their choice. Although the interviews are centred around the top of the South, the Nelson, Tasman and Marlborough regions where Fresh FM broadcasts, because of the wonderful response I've had from experts in different fields, it's now going out more with a more of a nationwide focus. But if we look at the Tasman, Nelson and Marlborough regions, although they're widely diverse economies, each of them is heavily underpinned by, for example, marine, tourism and rural sectors. And it seems to me that much of our forward planning is in fact predicated on the basis that in 20 years' time, things will look much the same, but we'll all just be driving EVs. Would you please set the scene for us by outlining what your crystal ball shows, that how things might look like in 20 years, recognizing that there could be quite a widespread range of conditions depending on how well humanity decarbonizes?
I'd just like to reflect, first of all, on the 20-year timeframe. And we're recording this just a few days before the 50th anniversary of the first Stockholm Environment Conference, which was the first time all the countries in the world had come together to discuss the state of the environment of the Earth. So that was 1972.
Wow.
And then we didn't get the Brundtland Commission on Sustainability, which flowed from that, reporting until 1987. And that was the wonderful work led by Brundtland, who at the time was Prime Minister of Norway. And this very simple definition of sustainability is that we shouldn't do anything today, I'm paraphrasing, which compromises the ability of future generations to do what they want to do. But since 1987, since the Brundtland Commission report, the human population has increased by 50% from 5 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, more than 50%, because it's from 5 billion people to 7.8. And we're also proportionately putting more pressure and more impact on not just the climate, but all of the Earth's systems, ecosystems and everything else. Then we didn't get the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate until 1992, which was also the same year we had the very wonderful Rio Conference.
Yes, yes.
Which brought climate into the picture, and the UNFCCC came out of that Rio conference. But then we didn't get the Kyoto Protocol, which was the first attempt to reduce emissions until 2005. And then that packed up without doing much. We finally got the Paris Agreement in 2015. And last year in Glasgow at COP26, we finally got the Paris Rulebook. So in other words, it took us 51 years from that first Stockholm Environment Conference to the Paris Rulebook, during which time the human population had continued to rise very rapidly, sure, as did emissions. Mm. So when I look ahead at the next 20 years, it's impossible to predict. And so if we think about the best outcome, it would be that we finally get serious, we get to grips on this extraordinary transformation that we need to make to ensure ultra-low emissions economies and societies. And 20 years takes us to the middle of 2042. Mm. So only just a few years before that very important mid-century goal of being net zero by 2050.
Sure.
So I, most of the time, am relatively optimistic that we're finally getting the understanding together that we need to do to tackle this, and we're starting to move things along. I don't think we will meet those goals of net zero by 2050, or indeed a 50% reduction in emissions by 2030. And I must just say about the net zero one by 2050, it's now very clear that about 90% to 95% of that has to be from actual emissions reduction.
Absolutely. It can't be by offsets.
Yeah. Mm. Because we need the offsets to start pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, not compensate for the more that we put up there.
Exactly.
So, but the point is, the better we do and the closer we get to those goals, the more manageable will be the climate crisis and the impacts we're dealing with. So that's the upside. And the downside is that we will spend, as we have the last 50 years, kind of messing around on all this. And that's not worth thinking about where we are then, because we are going to see not just higher temperatures, higher sea level, but drastic changes in ecosystems and everything else. So that's the parameters that we're working in. And I can't predict where we're going to go other than to urge everybody, as we many of us do all the time, is that these are truly, truly, utterly critical issues, and the better we get our heads around them, the more we do. It's not just about forestalling all those negative impacts. We actually deliver a whole bunch of even greater benefits. We restore ecosystems. We have cheaper energy. We make sure that everything we are using, we reuse. So we have less pollution, less wasted resources. The upsides to all this are truly transformational. And yes. And so that's my basic message on this. Just get our heads around it, and we've got to get on with this.
Thank you. And so I'm sorry to put the 20-year crystal ball in front of you. And on the one hand, it's nothing compared with the 50 years history you just talked about. And on the other, it's even 20 years is hard to predict, isn't it? But the broad picture is that one of the take-hearts messages from what you've said is we can get to a wonderful place if we really set our minds to it. Coming back to the local economy, becoming, quotes, less vulnerable to climate, close quotes, will mean very different things to different businesses, potentially ranging from a business as usual with a few tweaks to completely pivoting to having nowhere to go and closing right down. Getting an early sense of potential risks and pathways is critical to making the best of opportunities and avoiding the worst of disasters. But with all the uncertainty that you've just alluded to and misinformation out there, how can businesses get a realistic handle on what is likely ahead for them and on what options they might have?
For me, the key message that I draw from the companies which I think are the very best of this, both at home and abroad, is that they understand that they don't know what all that entails. Right. So they're making very sure that they are very forward-looking. They're very attuned to things as they're developing. But they are very eager to embrace change as they see how to do it. They are ambitious in all that. But above all, they are very adaptable. And even most important of all, they understand that what they have been doing up till now may continue to some degree for them, and there will still be very useful skills and knowledge that transfers in this. But they're ready and eager to learn how to do almost everything differently. So to me, the most important mindset is that one about being very open and eager for change. So they're trying to make their future rather than defend their past. That, to me, is the overwhelming issue for businesses. So within that, there are those that embrace that change. They live that change. They set themselves goals that are dictated by the science. And that's where we come back to the likes of the science-based target initiative, which are establishing carbon emission reductions based on what the climate models are telling us. So that's where the science comes in. And they have no idea how they're going to do that. But unusually for businesses, they set themselves those goals, knowing that that focuses their mind, focuses their energy, focuses their investment on finding out how to do that. And then the last thing for me always, and in many ways the best of all, is that they then collaborate very widely, because they know that the answers will lie quite likely outside their normal close links and close contacts, could be quite left field. But that's wonderfully liberating for them to be that open to where the knowledge, the help might come from. So embrace the change, be ambitious, and be very collaborative are the three messages. And then when you come to look at a regional economy like Tasman, Nelson, Marlborough, again, I want to stress that you can't take for granted that what you've been doing now, you'll be able to continue to do in largely the same fashion. Growing trees and harvesting them could well look very different 20 years from now, rather than just having plantation forests of radiata pine and then turning that into relatively low value wood products. And then similarly, I'm sure there will still be lots of farming and viticulture and the like, aquaculture going on in your region. But because the environment is changing so fast, the climate's changing so fast, and technology and science are changing so fast, those will look very different than they do now. And so if you are mid-career in any of those fields, say you're in your 40s, hopefully you'll still want to be still active in those businesses 20 years from now. But you're going to have to unlearn a lot of what you know now and learn a whole bunch of new stuff and be excited about that.
Look, wonderful. I always enjoy our discussions, Rod, because you bring so many interesting and well-informed perspectives. It's great. Thank you. I just wanted to sort of drift away from the ready and eager to change bit that you said and think, if you've got a message for those that are struggling to be ready and eager to change, whether they're people that just don't want to know or people that are denying it or whatever, do you have a tip for, you know, I'm a business owner and I think, oh, I've been doing okay like this for 20 years and I don't want to change. Do you have a tip for me, like where I can get information or who I can talk to or how I inject the right thought into my head on that?
I think the really important place to start is to know that you can ease your way into this by starting to pick up on the issues, by starting to see the opportunities there, but then, of course, grow rapidly from that. And there are lots of places for that entry. You would have friends or colleagues who might well be further along on this journey than you are, and so sit down and have a chat with them informally, hear what's going on. But then I'm impressed by the chamber in your region.
True, which excellent.
very switched on to this. You've got a wonderful zero carbon business group there in your region. Yes. And there are terrific national organizations, the Sustainable Business Council tending to be for larger companies and the Sustainable Business Network for smaller ones. Mm. And you've got some fabulous expertise in your region in these areas. And, you know, one of the beautiful things about us in New Zealand as a small country, there's very few degrees of separation.
Yes,
and
that's right.
It's very easy to get together with people to just start exploring the issues.
Thank you. That's a lovely follow-on answer to my unexpected question there. Thank you. I'd like to drift now into the area of local government, because local government is far from immune to economic vulnerability and also has a serious part to play in our economic well-being through, for example, their planning and regulations, their own commitments to activities like public transport, and through even their own business activities. I know our local councils are engaged in port activities and airports as well. If you were the advisor on long-term policy for one of our region's councils, here we are, I'm trying to put you on the spot here. How do you think you would be advising them in terms of optimizing the chances of their community thriving in 20 or 30 years?
I would start with essentially the same imperatives that I offered to business about, you know, embracing, living the change, being ambitious in what you're trying to do, and collaborating very widely. But for local councils, it's that last one which is the most important, because we've got to build up the understanding, the enthusiasm for this amongst all of our friends and neighbours and other people in our region, so that politicians can then take the decisions they need to in full consultation with us. So we get the plans, we get the regulations, we get the need we help. But there's an even, in a sense, an even bigger change happening in politics and democracy than that which I outlined in business, in that there is this early days, but very encouraging, very enlightening shifts towards people having a much greater role in what's decided and how it's decided. So that goes by various terms such as participatory democracy or deliberative democracy, which goes far beyond just voting at your local election once every 3 years.
Yes, yes.
Or perhaps turning up to a few council meetings or putting in a submission. But again, the political culture has to change there too, whereby politicians feel that they are far more the servant of the people, if you like, rather than elected to, you know, get stuff done. Mm. And again, it's this wonderful opportunity you have in a geographically coherent and varied region with a small population where those people-to-people connections are close, that, you know, you've got a wonderful opportunity to change the political culture. Because we've got to be able to agree on what we need to do over the long term, because these are long-term projects. And we can't be whipsawed around by short-term electoral politics or deeply embedded political ideologies. A point that's always often raised is, well, shouldn't we just have longer terms rather than just a three-year council? And my answer to that is absolutely not, because even if you went out to 4 or 5 years, that's still too short a time. So there are some examples of some countries around the world which have achieved democracies, which have achieved a great deal of common agreement about what they're trying to do over time. And then the electoral cycle just becomes who's delivering best on that. And are the incumbents doing a good enough job on delivering that? And so the elections or not should be changed. So the election is not about, shall we have a big change of direction here or a big change of policy? We're talking about which bunch of politicians look like the most capable of delivering. My favorite example of that was Ireland in the 1980s and 1990s, but there are others around. And that to me is the key to this, is that regardless of parties we might be members of or what some of our deep-seated ideological principles might be in politics, we can reach agreement on what we're trying to do here. And then from that, you begin to get really good progress. And the best example of how that works is the Land and Water Forum, which the Environmental Defence Society and others put to the John Key government. Nick Smith, obviously of your region, was Environment Minister at the time. And he very bravely agreed to do essentially a Scandinavian type of process on land and water, where all the stakeholders came together. And it took them about a year of sitting around a table, understanding the commonality they had on so many issues, people who were normally at loggerheads with each other. And then out of that, over the next couple of years, they developed a very full suite of freshwater reforms. But then the Key government made the mistake of only selecting the parts of that which they liked and they thought they could get through Parliament. But that is where the Scandinavian model completely broke down, because in Scandinavian politics, and of course, Guy Salmon of your region was leading all this work because he was a great expert on it. The Scandinavian model is that the government trusts the people to come together to design a coherent, integrated set of reforms, and then the government undertakes to
implement deliver
that. And so that was, you know, the great insight from Guy of Ecologic. But anyway, so that's the one example of where we tried that. And when the government would only enact some of that, the consensus broke down and the Land and Water Forum just petered out. But anyway, it's still a very good example of how we can work together, but we've got to understand how we need to run that process all the way through to its conclusion, rather than muck it up in the legislative stages.
Again, what an interesting answer. And I know in our area, we've had a bit of interest in citizens' assemblies, which I think have got a lot of kinship with that. I'm going to just pick up on a follow-up question to your answer just now, Rod, and that is that I think the way it broke down that you mentioned at the end picks up on something that came to my mind earlier in your answer, and that is, how do you settle on the core policies or approaches that you want the government to implement, regardless of the political flavor of the government? And interestingly enough, earlier in this series, I interviewed James Renwick, who I'm sure you know from the Climate Change Commission. And James's comment, I said, if you had a magic wand, what would you do? He said, I'd shower local government with resources and money. And and the reason for that was, he said, that would then take some of the vagaries of our three-year electoral cycle. So in a different way, he was trying to defuse the same issue that you've alluded to about having some sort of core direction that the elected members or politicians then implement in slightly different ways. So how do we get to that point of having an agreed core direction that you start to describe early on there?
I think the key to it is establishing mechanisms by which this happens. So it's not a question of saying, oh, let's just all kind of get together and have a good old chat. This needs to be structured as it was in the Land and Water Forum. And it needs to be focused, again, as it was just on land and water. It wasn't trying to solve every issue in society. So I think that's the absolute key to this. And of course, fully supported by all political parties that are going to honour that process, not only in supporting the people involved in it, because it's a lot of work and people need a lot of resource, professional advice, scientific advice. You know, they can't just do this in their spare time. You know, you need serious honorariums or better to reward people for that work. But then being serious about then having a legislative process that turns that into regulations and laws and gets them and then fully resources the likes of local councils to be able to implement that. So it's got to be a very thorough, very serious, very well resourced process.
In other words, it has to have good commitment from early on, doesn't it? Thank you, Rod. That, again, that's lovely and informative. I want to jump now onto a bit of a hobby horse of mine, because I've got a bit of a background in cost management in the construction industry, and my questions are going to relate to cost. A recurring complaint about many proposed climate actions is that they're, quotes, uneconomic or, quotes, too costly, but almost never do they come with the qualifier too costly over what time frame, or with a comparison with the cost of inaction, both of which might shed a very different light on things. And I know, for example, Lord Nicholas Stern is very strong on the difference between the cost of action and inaction. What suggestions do you have for citizens and for electoral candidates considering and debating these things around cost effectiveness in the lead up to the elections?
Well, the first thing is to know two things. One is that the cost of inaction or half-hearted inaction is truly horrendous. We're talking tens of trillions of dollars of damage and lost economic activity, lost value of all kinds of things, whether it be lives or livestock or businesses. The second thing is that the cost of new technologies and the cost of doing things very differently always starts on the high side. But as technologies are proven and commercialized, those costs come down very substantially. Yes. And therefore, once you build up some a good direction and some momentum on a given technology, it becomes ever more economic to implement. But the second thing, the next thing is that also know that we can achieve a great deal at essentially no cost, which is by changing our behavior. So we don't have, you know, EVs are fine, but EVs have a role, but you can make a dent in your transport emissions with virtually no investment at all. Well, none if you're going to walk, very little if you're going to ride a bike, a little bit if you're going to ride an electric bike, or depending on public transport, possibly nothing on public transport if you're a pensioner or it's already free in your area. So I think that those are some sort of simple truths that need to be driven home all the time, and, you know, backed with the very easy to articulate and verify point that we derive a lot of benefits from doing the right thing here beyond simply knocking emissions and climate change on the head. We gain a lot of other benefits too, which we never cost into all of this. And I think it's really important to keep emphasizing those, you know, basic truths in that as a way to encourage us to, you know, throw ourselves into these efforts and thus progress.
Thank you. And when you say a lot of other hidden benefits, my mind jumps to things like if you're on a bike, you're actually going to get fit, or there's going to be less parking demand in the city or something. Is that the sort of thing you had in mind?
Yeah, less air pollution. You know, it goes, you know, less people overweight, less people who feel sort of socially distanced, because some of these things have a very much a sort of a people base, a people connection to them. Then, of course, so it's not just in terms of personal health and well-being. Many of those benefits accrue to a whole community, so you get better, you know, community well-being. But then, of course, the biggest thing of all is we end up with an environment which is more acceptable to us as human beings than a much-changed climate changed by crisis would be.
Yeah, totally. And that's the ultimate cost of inadequate action, isn't it? Thank you. We're going to run out of time, I know, because I always enjoy talking with you so much. But one of the things I love about having someone like you on the program is that I can invite you to nominate your top take-home climate message or messages for people generally, but especially for listeners wanting to factor climate change into the coming local elections. Over to you to share your top takeaway message with us.
The first one is to emphasize that the way we've done things have often been the right decision at the time, but there is no guarantee that those are the right ones in the road ahead. So, for example, what's very much on my mind in your built environment in Nelson, Tasman, is your urban area is in a very tightly constrained bit of coast around the centre of Nelson and then out to up towards Richmond, etc. And that's been a very low density, single, possibly two-storey, typically with quite large gardens. That was fine for the 1950s or whatever.
Yes.
And that was very beautiful in its own way. But as we change and adapt to a very different world now, Nelson would still be a very attractive town, small town, by even national standards, let alone international standards, if it used land better. And I know it's a horrible word, greater housing density, because density is, sounds like such a turnoff. But for built environments to embrace nature and bring nature back into that built environment in a very profound way, not just a few beautiful pocket parks or a few more trees, but more food grown locally. And some of that might even be quite vertical. It doesn't necessarily all mean to be veggies in the patches in the back garden. There are so many wonderful examples around the world of towns and cities embracing nature that way, so that more people can live better in a given area, means that Nelson would be even more attractive and a better place to live for more people without pushing housing high up the hillsides or far out along flat bits of coast. And therefore, you would be preserving that natural environment outside the built-up environment for all the things that you love and all the things that you benefit from economically. So my basic encouragement there is to, think boldly about how your small towns in Nelson, Tasman, Marlborough, and communities could be much more effective in their built environments by working more closely with nature to build those very special built environments that dovetail magnificently with natural environments.
Fabulous. Thank you. That's an excellent take-home message. Thanks, Rod. And from my observation of intensification around New Zealand, the integration with nature that you've referred to is a message we should take dear to our hearts, because I think from my observation, they've done that much better in Europe than we have here. So I hope that we achieve that very important outcome as well. I know you've often talked about the importance of restoring our connection with nature, and I'm completely on board with that. On that note, I'm going to thank you again for joining us and for your sharing your wonderful diversity and insightful comments. And we look forward to having you again, either on climate matters or back in our region at some time in the not too distant future.
Well, thank you. I actually very much look forward to my next visit down your way.
Well, isn't it wonderful to be able to gain the insights and wisdom of someone like Rod and his such a breadth of experience. It's just terrific. Now, I promised to give you listening options for the series People, Places and the Climate Crisis. You can listen to the full interview with each guest on their own podcast, and these are available on Spotify, Apple and other main platforms, and they can be linked from my firm's website, which is www.resilience, that's R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-Z, resilience.co.nz, and there you can navigate to our podcast page. That page will also give you the full schedule of the podcasts, plus links to Fresh FM's broadcasting frequencies and their website, where you can stream the radio shows, where most interviews are condensed to about half the length or less than on the podcasts themselves. As always, I want to give a big thanks to Kahu Sanson-Burnett, who's doing a great job as the sound tech and as making the podcast access so smooth. And of course, a big thanks to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for being part of this important conversation. We have still more fascinating experts coming up on the series. The next ones are on regenerating nature, where we have two Simons, Simon Miller, who is the executive director of Pure Advantage, and Simon Stewart, who is a freshwater ecologist at Cawthron Institute. Well, both well worth listening to. So we hope we have your company again next time. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.